Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of VFE. And today's guest is an absolute brother from another mother. Now, I love this because we already have, like I say, our pre-podcast recording where Wes and I, we were the host for the Ear Show at the ASUSV Summit, but wanted to bring it live to you here in San Diego. Wes and I are known as Salt and Pepper. That was kind of our stage name that we had. But when we get to it, what does Wes do? He is the Administrator of Innovation and Artificial Intelligence for the Orange County Department of Education, one of the leading voices in artificial intelligence, integration of AI in education, and also I think just a thought partner for anybody across the country when it comes to digitalization, specifically with various systems within our operating model. But in all seriousness, Wes has been just doing the work for AI. And I'm glad to actually bring him on this podcast episode because, again, we are going to ask the hard questions pertaining to artificial intelligence in education, but more importantly, what does it look like from the system level on down to the classroom level as well? So without further ado, I want to introduce to you my salt brother, right? You're salt and pepper.
Salt brother.
My salt brother from another mother. At the AI show, he is known as that. But here and across the education ecosystem, we want to welcome Mr. Wes Kriesel from Orange County Department of Education. Wes, a.k.a. Salt. What's up, brother?
Hey, man, I am so glad to be here. And I've seen your podcast. I know the caliber of people that you have on here. It's an honor. It's an honor. And I hope we have a good time today.
Oh, yeah, Wes, we will. And actually, it's an honor to have you on VFE because I know your national work that you're doing, that you're underscoring across the country. Moreover, I think Orange County and the work that you're doing, as well as Kunal, that the both of you are doing, is leading the nation around creating organizational coherence, right? Coherence in the context of AI in education, integrated in systems, but more importantly, driving that level of innovation. So I want my audience, Wes, to be able to not only fill your expertise, but to unpack it and scaffold it so that they can be able to apply next-in-class practices and best practices in this area or this phrase of AI education. So, Salt, should we get started?
Let's get started.
Let's get started. Now, Wes, I know you are a national voice with AI, various emerging technologies, specifically around software innovation of the operating model with AI, running that kind of like that synergistic relationship. But I didn't get to ask you this question in San Diego, but I want to ask it now. What song describes your leadership signature in the education ecosystem?
All right. So think about it. There must be higher love. Steve Winwood. So I think the idea of leadership typically is somebody associated with directives, mandates, guidance, like somebody who's looking out for the vision, the horizon. And it's often like a commander type figure. And I really think that a higher love, a higher purpose, a higher guide, if people don't sense that from you, all those guidances, commands, mandates, all those are going to feel kind of hollow. Right. And so they have to sense that you are connected to helping people improve their lives. And so anytime people ask, like, what's like, that's a typical question. What's your why? I always think my job, my why I come to work every day is to improve the lives of students and families and faculty and staff. You know, it's as simple as that. If I can't make somebody's life better, then find something else to do.
Yeah. No, Wes, great response, because there must be a higher love, right? And higher love, higher purpose and that commitment to improving the lives of, I like to say, most important customers, i.e. our families and students, and our most important practitioners, i.e. our leaders and our teachers. And I really love how you stated that, you know, our why, kind of like that, I like to say that rhetorical question that we hear in education, whether it be from a cultural standpoint or even just an initial introduction, improving the lives of the people that we serve, our family, students, leaders, and teachers. And I think that's an essential question that we have to always continue to revisit and unpack, because we're seeing various dimensions of the education ecosystem shift. And what we want to do is ensure that we are improving the lives of our most important customers, our most important practitioners, in alignment to these radical shifts that we're seeing. Specifically, Wes, when we think about building AI literacy and fluency, we always have to ensure that we're improving the lives within those verticals in itself. Great response for that. But Wes, your work in the Orange County Department of Education, I always like to say it is a textbook version of the book Innovation by Design. What you are doing, just adding those various elements of AI. But you, as the administrator of innovation and artificial intelligence for the Orange County, and those are, and to my audience, Orange County consists of multiple districts that West provides facilitation, support, direct leadership to the superintendents and their individual teams and schools as well. So we're talking about not just one district, we're talking about multiple districts that West is providing AI innovation support. But Wes, in an elevator speech to educators, or even, and I'm going to go to a different vertical that's outside of the education system, right? If you, to give your work in an elevator speech, whether you're giving a pitch to startup founders, or whether it be traditional educators from leadership or even a classroom context, what is an administrator of innovation and AI, and how is this a critical position to leverage students and learning organizations for the 22nd century, moving beyond, because of Generation Alpha Beta, the 22nd century?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I mean, my first instinct is to move beyond hype to meaningful use. Like right now, there's a lot of words flying around what AI is, what it can do. A lot of people who have are heading up companies that have taken investment dollars. And so there's a lot of pressure on them to sell a solution. And a lot of these solutions are not maybe terribly well thought out in terms of what is the meaningful use of it. There's a use of it, there's an use of it, but a meaningful use. So in our work, we always ground something in what is the interaction with the student look like? And I know there's a lot of fear right now about like putting students on an AI chatbot and having more screen time. And that's actually not what we look for. We look for how can AI be used in community to develop relationships between people, to strengthen those human-centered moments that we care about and that we absolutely believe in. And so we have three pillars here that we talk about, and I'll mention them. Ethical integration, so just making sure we're not breaking any laws with data privacy. There's bigger questions about AI, you know, how it's affecting the world, the water that's used in it. There's things like that we should be thinking about. But also ethically, in terms of what do we do with the number of minutes where we have a student with us for learning. And so it's a layered cake, if you want to think of it that way. But there's really two other pillars. One is innovating in learning, and the other one is workforce readiness. And I'll say the ethical integration question has really captured everyone's imagination and attention. And we're endeavoring to shift so that we're not just talking about AI questions by themselves, but we're also tying them to these other pillars of, well, what should learning look like in the 22nd century, and what jobs are emerging, and how our industry is shifting, so that we can advise our school districts so that they're not preparing students for things that are no longer a valid career for them. I just saw a stat last night. It hurts me, but it was like basically like your return on investment for your major. And it was, you know, at the top was engineering and computer science. And all the way down at the bottom, it was almost like if you studied fine art, you were likely to lose money by going to college for that. And, you know, my wife's a writer and we talk about starving artists and it's a joke, it's a cliche. But like when you see the research, you're like, oh, that's actually true, that it's a very difficult proposition to make money by going into fine arts. The next one up from that was education. People who studied education were the least likely to make X number of dollars or X, you know, factor of income. So when I was studying, I didn't have a grid like that. And money's not the answer to everything, but we have this research. And so how are we informing our, and to go back to the why, if the families I support are trying to, you know, break out of generational poverty, if they're trying to make it as a family that's come to the United States from somewhere else, I should be presenting like, hey, here, it's like a financial advisor, like, hey, here are the options. But we should also look at who the student is and what they're passionate about and what their gifts are and what their strengths are and their interests are. And we can do a great job of having these conversations with students about who are you, where is the path leading in the future. And actually, AI can do a great job with helping us in these conversations just by transcribing, analyzing, offering connections that maybe a traditional educator wouldn't see. We can build systems like that.
Truly appreciate that answer, specifically the phrase of you saying meaningful use, right? A meaningful utility of AI. But I want to expand on the three pillars that OC is unpacking and underscoring in their practices within all of your learning organizations within the county. Ethical integration, and I really love the twist of it where it's focusing on number of minutes for learning. I think that's essential. We're going to get back to that, but I want you to unpack these two pillars because this is where I believe, and again, this is just my hypothesis, cursory from qualitative data that I've been collecting. It can be challenged in any research aspect of it because there wasn't any formal methodology. I do have people in the research world that watch the show, or I want to clarify that so there won't be any misnomers out there. Innovation and learning and workforce learning and development. Okay. When I think of that, and then you started to elaborate on aligning these pillars to passion, strengths, and pathways. Wes, you and I know our Jeffersonian model is fossilized by design, and we're still underscoring and underpinning these practices from the model. And again, you know, there's no, I always say this, whether it be speaking nationally or internationally or anywhere, is that I don't like to blame people because we are just, it's more of a residual effect because the construct and the model design is industrialized. So when we think about innovating and learning, pillar two, workforce learning development, pillar three, focusing on students' passion, strengths, and then designing pathways, right, for students that are personalized, how do we shift the model design to be in accordance to, let's say, these three pillars of ethical integration, innovative learning, and workforce learning and development? That's a radical shift, and it takes time, including mental models and culture. Where do we start, Wes?
I'm glad you asked me that because I have a presentation next week where I'm trying to unpack all this for our county office leadership. So I'll pitch these two and you can push back on me. I think we're doing a good job with the AI integration ethically. Like we're working on literacy lessons for students. We're working on micro-credentialing and badging educators for AI fluency. Not worried about that. that's new. It's different, but it's pretty standard. Like when the internet showed up, or technology, or digital citizenship, we have methods for this. Not everyone's as comfortable with AI and new technologies as I am, but I'm like, oh, that's pretty standard. So innovation and learning, this is to me the opportunity. And I'm looking at Tom Van Der Ark's work. If you go to Getting Smart, you can find like schools worth visiting, innovative learning systems. And so what we're trying to build in Orange County is a directory internally of schools to visit. Like, you need to see a STEM program. You need to see a dual immersion program, right? Our districts know what they do well, and they will maybe once in a while do like a community field trip. My last district did that. Hey, come one, come all, and we'll take you on a bus and show you the different programs. Because schools in the last 10, 15 years, one of the messages they've heard clearly is you need to diversify and have a value proposition. You're not just the neighborhood school. You're a magnet for business. You're the arts academy. And so one of the things at the county office that we have the opportunity to do is to create a countywide learning organization, right? So pulling on Senge's work is to help us be able to see each other in our glory. And we don't have to compete with that. We don't have to be that, but we should celebrate it and know where it is, because we can learn from that. And so I think, you know, one of the opportunities is paying attention to what charters are doing. I read a stat like 500 new charters pop up a year and 200 or 300 close. So we should be paying attention to like, well, what's going on with a charter that sustains over a year? Like, that's, they're beating the odds, right? Innovation and learning, I think we need to develop a directory where we can send people and say, this is what a system looks like. You know, it's like when a school gets a visitor, they go to the one classroom where, you know, the classroom management's on a lock and the kids are engaged and, oh, don't go in that other room. But, you know, across the county, we need to go not just for orderliness or traditions of the past, but innovations. We should have a directory. Okay. So then workforce readiness, I think our job is to say, here's the trends, here's the research. And then show district leaders and say, you're already doing X, Y, and Z. Here's the trends in the research of where industry is going. Let's use AI to map out different possibilities, different scenarios to create a crosswalk or an articulation. You don't have to change everything you're doing, but you have to be. I mean, it's like if you just drove down the highway and you didn't ever looked at your GPS of where your final destination point is. You know, you need guidance. And part of our duty in education is to get students to a profitable and, you know, that's used intentionally, a profitable future. You know, we don't want them just to be, you know, educated and can quote Shakespeare, but they are not contributing to their families, you know, financial success. That's real, you know?
Yeah. Wes, thank you for that, because a directory of models is essential that we can actually see these next in class practices and practice in itself. But I really love the aspect for workforce learning development, workforce readiness. You're focusing on the trends and the research of the industries. And plus, I've been stating that a lot these days, that, you know, because I get asked the question, A, how do we design innovation for workforce development and workforce readiness? And I always say that what we need to do is essentially do industry analyses, market research, and look at what are the economic trends and patterns so that we can be able to design these pathways that are in alignment to workforce development for and workforce readiness. 22nd century. That great answer, Wes. That was an amazing answer.
And just to tie in one other element is industries are different in different regions. Like, I was at a CTE conference last year, and it was great information being shared in the LA area. These industries are emerging and these are declining, but you go into a rural area and it's different. And so those organizations need to be aware of it. It's not one size fits all with the industry growth and also the decline. I mean, those are real things.
Absolutely. I mean, Wes, one of the verticals that could be different from Orange County. I know that we're working with a district in New Mexico, and we're looking at rural entrepreneurship and defining what that looks like specifically in the industry areas for that state and that local economy. But Wes, I want you to clarify something for me, right? And as the education ecosystem, we're continuing to experiment. They use that word so much because I remember, Wes, in the BC stage of education before COVID, I would say experimentation or experiment from the aspect of R&D, L&D, research, development, learning, development. I would have people say to me, you are not going to experiment on my kid. My kid is not a widget. And I would have stakeholders say to me, how can you experiment? This is not a lab. But now we're actually using the word experimentation more willingly and autonomously, which is great. You were using that word 6-7 years ago. I'm like, yeah, I know. But when we think about the ecosystem and their continuous experimentation with various AI tools, what are the biggest, Wes, misconceptions that we must address to achieve systems, as you were talking about with the three pairs, and instructional alignment, especially first pair, second pair, even bring it down to that third pillar that you were talking about. But how do we achieve systems and instructional alignment in our learning organizations to alleviate these broad misconceptions of AI in education?
So I'm going to steal a concept from the superintendent in La Habra, Dr. Mario Carlos. We're having this phone call preparing for a conference, a talk I was giving where he was going to share some insight. And I swear there's a direct quote. He said, an organization needs two brains. And I was like, okay, tell me more about that. And so Dr. Carlos is like, you need a governance approach to AI. Like, you have to have a task force. You have to work on that policy document. You have to convene people. You have to have those meetings and follow that timeline. And it's got to be buttoned up and clearly communicated. And the other brain that you have to have is an R&D brain. You need a lab space. You need an experimental space, a play space. You need hallway conversations. You need AI on every agenda for every group, from classified staff to principals to teachers. You have to, like he said, they just have to get their hands dirty. And getting their hands dirty and experimenting, to use your word, is not the same place as the governance space. And people try to do this, both work in the same space, and it's going to fail. It's going to fail, you know? So building both is, it's as puzzling as, you know, having an organization have two brains, you know? It could be the same people, but I would say you probably have different people who excel at both. Yeah, they need to talk to each other and report back to each other. But so I think that's one. And that goes back to that original, the song question about higher love, is we think in terms of hierarchy, and we kind of go up to like, okay, the superintendent's calling all the shots. But then when the superintendent says, oh, we need two brains, then you have to say, oh, that's a wholly different model that has a lot more love and compassion and like give and take than hierarchy and leadership. And I'm just going to be the one person who says everything for the organization.
Now, Wes, I love your answer and your response with that, because when I think of that two brains that Carlos was talking about, I was automatically referencing, right, this distribute leadership model that underscores the principle of knowledge work, right? We're so used to that, as you stated, that hierarchy around managerial work, you know, the highly structured, tightly coupled systems where the decision-making process is top to bottom, right? Where now, if you're moving to this two-brain approach around the governance to AI and lab space, experimental space with that, you're creating this continuous learning for innovation and autonomy to experiment, and you're guiding that facilitation. Huge shift. That right there is a huge cultural shift. Now, to achieve that, right, Wes, I'm going to continuously to ask you these questions, one word question, right, so that now we could continue to unpack your thinking. Two words, how and why. Right? Why this two two brain governance, lab space, experimental space. And then again, kind of goes back to one of the questions that was just asked previously of how do we achieve that? Because we're always looking, as you stated, overlapping or interfacing, when in reality it should be equilibrium between the both.
Yeah. I feel like it's the two brains. I mean, it could be a metaphor for just being human, right? Because I have to remember my appointments. I have to remember to get dressed. I have to, you know, brush my teeth. I have to drive the speed limit. Like, I have all those things. But if I'm only the sum of me following the rules, it's a very empty life, right? The parts that make us dream and desire and want, like, it, everything about, like, you could analyze, you know, the top 100 movies of all time, you know, following the rules, being a rule follower is a implied antagonist in most movies, and breaking the mold and being the hero and stepping out against is the force that the hero needs to pay attention to. So in our systems, we rely so much on a culture of compliance and control just because of our factory model or whatever you want to say. I mean, that's just how it was designed from the ground up. So how do you build a space for safety and people to be willing to risk? I mean, a lot of it comes to developing communities that care, communities that talk to each other, communities that listen. I always, in my work, I always use structured speaking protocols so that it helps distribute time among the people, because all things being equal, the talkative person is going to talk the most. And then all of a sudden you have a situation that's not equitable, right? Just because of force of personality, or the person with the most positionality in the room is going to be deferred to. Like, I don't know, superintendent, what do you think? And they may want to hear from people, but the hierarchy in place supersedes that. So if you structure time so that everyone gets a chance, this is so simple, is like a whip around. Like, everyone, you know, say one thing you're grateful for as a check-in. And then at the end, I always do a debrief. So in those spaces where we're trying to create, I mean, we don't need a lot of help creating rules and systems. I mean, we're good at that. But to create space for people to connect is just structuring time. Like, let everyone have a beat to say an emotional reaction to what happened. And that's based on a book I read a long time ago. Like, I think it's called Structured Reflective Conversations for Schools. And it's a quote that just came to me. I think it's Roland Barthes, says the level of academic success in schools is directly tied to the level of collegiality. So if colleagues are not talking and they're not friendly and they're not conversing and sharing ideas, it's this open culture where you have, I won't call it friendship, but you have the human connection at the root of the work, the higher love, if you want to speak, like, we're all on the same mission, we're all going the same place. That's part of creating this second brain. I think second brain is so stark an image that it's fun to use, but it really is, like, you know, set up a separate group to do AI experiments, you know, AI play spaces, have AI play dates where the staff gets together, and it's not training, it's just trying things out. Yeah.
Yeah, and that, and you know, Wes, that will lead to the acceleration and expansion of innovation on a much quicker level, right? Because when they start, I like to say, in that play space where they're using the tools for themselves and then having control the A/B testing, and I'm sorry, control treatment testing, and there's that A/B sketch that they're running. I think that that's how we scale innovation to a higher degree. But now this question goes back to one of the lines of pillar one that you were talking about, and in underpinned by governance, because there's a myriad of different ethical discussions regarding consideration of students. And I want to get into the data aspect of this now, because we always talk about the front end experience, but I think that we need to talk about the back design and the data sets that we're underscoring or using. How to eliminate these hallucinations and these large language models And when we look at the deep fakes out there and the biases, you know, we prompt specific statements or ask questions, you know, within these platforms, and we get these outputs that, you know, obviously contradict what we're looking at, right? So, Wes, how do we now, specifically in education, our vertical, with all this stated, how do we eliminate risk? And what should leaders be aware of in their district, specifically, as you started to allude to, but I want you to go a little deeper to this, with the guidelines and the policies when it talks about this continuous evolution of AI in our schools?
I would point to a simple move by Santa Ana Unified School District is they put together a statement, and it says right there, AI is going to continue to change. We will revisit this every 6 months. And it's such a simple move, and it's not a rhetorical move. It's a signal to the community that this is going to continue our vigilance. Like, it's going to continue to demand that we be vigilant. And I think that that's good, because the vigilance is on multiple levels, right? There's layers around student screen time and student, whether the outcomes, the output is detrimental to students, right? There's been examples where, you know, an AI chatbot has told a student, you should, you know, consider suicide or whatever. Like, that should never be the case, right? We always have to be vigilant. But then there's larger, you know, considerations that aren't about the single child. It's about, you know, what's developmentally appropriate. You know, ed tech vendors and AI industry is going to say, oh, use it everywhere because it's amazing, you know, but it's not developmentally appropriate. You know, what is developmentally appropriate is that we develop our human attachments at a very early age. And that's important. And maybe screens and computers and things become more important as we get older, but we need to make those decisions. And then I think on the other side, the programming side, the development side, the training, the model side, is where are the educators at the table in that? And I always, you know, I'm always curious what's the diversity of the organization programming the models, and how are they even thinking? Like, if they can't answer that question, like, you know, why is it that the whole team is white males programming this? Like, if that's their approach just in their hiring practices, and you can go, well, it just, you know, it's just happened. We hired the best people, right? But that's not the way the world looks. And so you're recreating something already that doesn't match our school system. So getting educators into those discussions about who the people are and how the models are being trained, that's important. And these are ethical dilemmas, really. There's nothing out there that's like, oh, we can fix this just by doing what I just said, right? We're going to continue to ramp up the water usage because of the AI investment that's being made. And we're going to continue to have models trained and made behind closed doors where there's not enough transparency. But it doesn't mean you don't participate. This is now part of our civic arena, right? So you have to get involved. You don't close your eyes. You just have to go, okay, all right, let's look around the team. Who are we going to assign? We need a point person on, you know, AI ethics, you know, at the student level, at the system level, and at the, you know, almost the global corporate level. You need a lookout, a scout, somebody to go and investigate, you know. And that's not the total answer, but that's a start.
That is great. No, Wes, that is, I was going to respond to you that is a great answer, right? And you're one of the first individuals, of course, it would be you, to make a recommendation that educators be a part of the actual design, testing, and training of these models. Because, Wes, you're absolutely correct. And now that, you know, and you know, Wes, I live in kind of like two different spaces, right? I live in our education space, the practitioner space, researcher space, but I also now live in this software design with engineers, UX design, psychometricians who are building these models. And Wes, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't see many that either look like me, that are, you know, very minimal, right? Very minimal. I see that. And also too, our brown brothers and sisters don't see them. And then women I don't see, right? So, and I see this context of, you know, why the end user had these output experiences, I look on the back end design and the individuals that are designing these models. And again, it's nothing against them. The individuals that are designing these models, they're bringing their implicit biases into the design, which how we get these hallucinations, how we get these big deep fakes within our models in itself. So I think it's very important that we do start including, even though it is a different, I always like to say this whole programming and big data analytics language is a different language, but again, we can be able to ensure that there's that level of interdependency. And I like to say multidimensional design with including educators. But Wes, I want to ask you a question, right? And I want you to define this. And this is more of a selfish question that I'm asked for my audience, right? So define innovation in AI in the instructional model for learning organizations, right? Because what I'm afraid of, Wes, is that we have this misalignment. I love when Ken Sheldon, he came on a while ago, he stated that, you know, we have this high level, or when we talk about Bloom's, you know, we're at the top of the level with Bloom's taxonomy in the context of identifying different tools, but we're very low in Bloom's when it comes to instructional rigor. So we're seeing that misalignment, right? And I love how Ken Sheldon, shout out to you, Ken, for putting that in context. But how do we now, Wes, define an innovation in AI, create that alignment between technology and software and the learning needs of the students?
Oh, that's a great question. And Ken's great. And I love, like, he can just stop a room with a sentence that, you know, people's like, I never thought of it that way. You know, they start crying and going, what do we do now? Okay, I'm maybe not going to answer the question, but I do have thoughts. So I used to hold on to the word innovation as the solution, right? I thought, you know, systems of school have been set up according to kind of past needs, the factory model, all that. And so I really thought that's, I mean, people say it's broken, but it's really doing what it's designed to do. We've also heard that. So I always thought, like, doing something new is the number one move to try to get a different output, like higher student engagement, you know, better academic outcomes. You know, the definition of insanity is, you know, keep doing the same thing over and over. I was always like, do something new. And I thrive in chaos and change. Like, that's where I get lit up and I start to see divergent connections that we didn't see before in a static environment. But I think I'm starting to think that that's not the right answer. And I think that the right answer might have to do with entrepreneurship. And I think entrepreneurship is just identifying a problem and thinking of a solution rooted in a community that you belong to. Like, I'm not really talking about, like, hey, a corporation has an entrepreneurial endeavor they want to sell me.
Wes, can you say that definition of innovation one more time for my audience?
So I would say it's an entrepreneurial focus, right? Is identifying a problem and then identifying a solution for a community that you're a part of. And I'll point to Don Wetrick. I heard him on the Getting Smart podcast not long ago. He has a company or a organization called Startup Ed, trying to encourage entrepreneurial endeavors with students. And my answer is two parts, because I think students are half of the equation and adults are the other half. So in his talk on the Getting Smart podcast, he talked about, if you take the disenfranchised students, the students who aren't engaged by school, he's like, they have the ability to locate the greatest number of opportunities for innovation because they're not satisfied. They can tell you what's wrong with school. They can name those problems. You know, you take the straight A student, the valedictorian, what's wrong with school? I don't know. It's working, right? And so you talk to the dissatisfied customers, and you create a space where they can identify and then work on those problems. And that's an entrepreneurial model. However, that will never, ever, ever, ever fly if adults don't get the same opportunity, right? And too often we're going, hey, here's the contract with the teacher association. We're going to abide by X, Y, and Z. It's very rigid. And so we're not going to go beyond. I have some things that bother me about the system, but I'm going to just kind of lay low and wait till I collect my pension. There's brilliance in the educational system, in the educators who know it more intimately than anybody. So how do we create an entrepreneurial space for them to go, I see a problem, I see a solution for my teachers, for my administrators, for my students. So you, if you have, and maybe this is back to the organization with two brains, is one of the brains is an entrepreneurial learning organization, you know, from Senge, is like, we're gonna really figure out how to do life in this organization better. So I think that's where I would go. Innovation in my past was always, you know, trying something new is good in it in of itself, but I think really rooting it in the community and problem solving with a purpose for that community is where, take all the AI chatbot companies, right? They are not thinking about your community. They are not thinking about the problems you face. They're just thinking about shiny new tech and I can put it into an educational system and sell it, right? But if you think about, hey, you know, the problems with English learners and getting reclassified has to do with the number of words they produce in a given school day. So just, oh, well, how could I give students more chances to talk, right? So then you have some, you know, Oco is another one I've heard of, Matt Miller recently. He has an AI chatbot where it requires the students to talk in a small group, right? So he's solving a small group management issue, but he's also using AI and he's also engaging students. So like that idea is far more aligned with what's a problem that the community has, language production, classroom management, all in one solution. And they're far too few. And it could be, crazy idea, not enough educators are, you know, on the development side.
Wes, 100%, because, you know, first I want to say this, Wes, thank you, because I don't know if you know that your answer just reassured me about the Agile Diagnostic and AI platform. I love that, Wes, because you said that it takes the community context in mind. And as I was initially designing this with Daniel and team, from a software standpoint, right, of development, the development process of it was taking into consideration the context of our communities, right? The context of our students, of our practitioners, and really being that facilitated empowerment tool for those community of leaders to make systemic and meaningful change. I love the aspect, and as you were presenting, I'm like, wow. And I'm going to explore this. Can the 21st century definition of innovation in education be challenged with a 22nd definition of entrepreneurial innovation in education, in part and parceling that? But I really love that really simple definition. That's why I had you repeat it. Essentially, identifying a problem, identifying a solution within a community to be able to continue to iterate around that specific prototype. I know I'm using a lot of that language. I apologize, but you're making me think. This is probably going to be one of your hardest questions that anybody's going to ever ask. All right, Wes Kriesel, this is going to be very hard. I'm only going to limit you to three words. Three words, Saul. Three words. You can't go beyond that. Now, we have some rule breakers from the past where they go three times whatever, you know, three by the 25th power, 300 words in. So, Wes, I'm giving it to you, so take it as it is. So, what three words do you want our audience to leave with regarding this new predictive trend, right? The economic trends with AI in the AC stage of education and AC stage of education, meaning after COVID-19.
Number one word, fluency. People throw out literacy. With AI, that is bare bones, bare minimum. You're just trying to be compliant, get the kids their three lessons like we did with digital citizenship. Literacy doesn't help me when I travel to another country. And believe me, AI is another country. There's so much landscape there. You can't even imagine what's there. So you got to be fluent. When you get there, it's back to the entrepreneurial scenario I described. There's a context in a community, right? AI literacy suggests AI is academic and we can just handle it with some, you know, decoding skills. But to be fluent in AI, you're going to a place you haven't been, and you have to communicate about how you want to get to where you're going. So it's about purpose. Equity. I'm going to just quote our superintendent here. He's in a wheelchair and he's like, should I give everyone wheelchairs because I need one? Right. He just called it out. He's like, just doing things equally is not the approach that makes sense. And he highlights it with that wheelchair. And my sister's in a wheelchair. So like, I think, you know, I that resonated with me a lot. Right. And so equity is being strategic, savvy, and socially connected to the context to know what needs are. Right. So that's my second word. This is aspirational. It's humanity. It's the number one way that we go into an AI future with joy is holding tight to the things that we love, right? You know, we love each other. We love our families. We love eye contact. You know, those things that we enjoy. It's weird, joy. We don't have a metric for joy, but when you walk into a school where there's joy, you feel it. When you walk into a school that's more focused on compliance than curiosity or one of these other, you know, approaches to learning, you feel it. Yeah. So maybe we need a joy meter, an AI joy meter for the future.
I'm going to add that as a fourth, AI joy meter. All right. But the three words of fluency, equity, and humanity, it equates to high level success for students, Generation Alpha, Generation Beta, in the 22nd century. Great having you on VFE, Brother Wes. If any of my audience members have follow-up questions or want to go deep with, you know, the three pillars that you're underscoring within your districts or with your districts in Orange County, how would they be able to get in contact with you?
That's my email address, wkriesel@ocde.us. Simple as that. Drop me a line and I'll respond. I read my email. AI reads some of it. AI reads some of it.
To my audience, please get in contact with Wes. I consider him, he won't say it to you, but I will say he is one of the national experts when it pertains to AI and education, specifically lamenting innovation in AI in the synergistic manner. Wes, it was an absolute honor to have you on VFE. Brother, I miss you. I think we're going to have to try to do it again at the AI show. Because listen, Michael, if you're listening out there, yes, bring us back, right?
That was fun. Part two
of it. But in all seriousness, Wes, continue impacting and influencing the education ecosystem. And thank you for everything that you're doing.
Thank you, sir. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.